Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for waiting. Welcome to the New York State Sensation Center Collaborative Conference Call. All lines have been placed on listen-only mode, and the floor will be open for your questions and comments following the presentation. Without further ado, it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to your host, Ms. Anne Wendland. Ms. Wendland, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Wes. Good afternoon. This is Anne Wendland, Cessation Programs Manager for the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control. And on behalf of the New York State Tobacco Cessation Centers and the Smokers Quit Line, I would like to welcome you to today's call, Denormalizing and Treating Tobacco in Addiction Services. You may view today's presentation in one of two ways, as a webinar or by downloading the slides posted on the New York State Smokers Quit Line website. Links to the slides and webinar are posted on the collaborative call page of the Quit Line website, nysmokefree.com. To access today's presentation, go to nysmokefree.com. On the left-hand side of the website's homepage, there is a newsfeed section. Within this section, there's an announcement for today's call. Click on the link provided, and it'll bring you to the page for today's webinar. On the same page, under Tools, you will find a list of New York State cessation centers with their respective service areas. Cessation center staff are available to assist your organization with developing and implementing tobacco dependence treatment policies and clinical protocols. Our featured speaker today is Tony Klein, Manager of Outpatient Services at the Unity Hospital of Rochester, Unity Chemical Dependency in Brighton, New York. Mr. Klein has over 25 years of clinical and administrative and training experience and is well known for addressing tobacco dependence in behavioral health settings. On today's call, Mr. Klein will describe the neurobiological and behavioral associations of tobacco use to other drugs of addiction. He will also discuss barriers and solutions to effectively integrate tobacco interventions into existing addiction services, including two fundamental aspects of evidence-based tobacco dependence treatment. We are pleased to offer CME, CRCE, and OASIS continuing education credits to today's listeners of the presentation. To fulfill the requirements of continuing education credit, we are required to disclose the following. Mr. Klein has no real or perceived vested interests that relate to his presentation, nor does he have any relationship with pharmaceutical companies and or other corporations whose products or services are related to pertinent therapeutic areas. To obtain continuing education credit, follow the instructions on the course credit and evaluation forms posted on the Quitline website. In addition, at the end of the webinar, you can complete the forms online if you prefer. A link to the online form and the paper form at the Quitline website will be provided on the webinar chat box and on the Quitline website. Please remember, applications for credit will not be accepted after January 15th. That's 1 week from today. So be sure to submit your applications as soon as possible to receive credit. Now it is my pleasure to turn the call over to Tony Klein. Tony?
Thank you, Anne. It's nice to be with you. Happy New Year, everyone. I entitled today's talk, Denormalizing and Treating Tobacco and Addiction Services, to emphasize the importance to strategically advance change to the social norms surrounding tobacco use within this clinical population while implementing stop smoking treatment protocols. My presentation today will describe an integrated, recovery-oriented systems approach. Think of a marriage between a public health model that focuses on population change and a behavioral health intervention where we're focusing on the individual. I learned that this type of a parallel process works best for implementation of tobacco-free environmental policy, as well as to promote high utilization of cessation services, what I call tobacco recovery. So let's get into the slides here. I think this works. Anne acknowledged that there's no conflict of interest, and she did acknowledge the learning objectives as well. So to meet our learning objectives, I'm going to expand on these following areas. Individuals with substance use disorder or co-occurring disorder are more vulnerable to tobacco use disorder. This is due to comorbidity factors, and we'll highlight some of that information. Tobacco use behavior is often fundamental to the use rituals of other substances. This is huge. If we're looking at addressing tobacco in addiction treatment services, modifying behavior patterns is fundamental to what we do. If the alcohol is always smoking while drinking, or after someone is done with their joint of marijuana, they light up a cigarette to boost their high. If someone is chain smoking while getting high on cocaine, as providers, it's core to our mission to look at that behavior and talk about it in terms of their treatment and rehabilitation. Effective implementation strategy must include provision to denormalize tobacco use in the treatment and recovery culture. I'm going to talk about some organizational change and how we can help influence attitudes and beliefs within the recovering community through various means. And then the last one here, behavioral health providers have highly developed clinical competencies to treat tobacco addiction. You know, by the nature of our clinical training, the counseling methods we utilize, the quality of the therapeutic alliance we form with our patients, including the frequency of patient contact, all of these factors afford us a great opportunity that really isn't found in other areas of healthcare. So if we know how to coach someone through an alcohol craving, it's the exact same dialogue and technique to manage tobacco craving. We have highly involved skill sets and experience, and we need to acknowledge that as well as, I think, utilize those skill sets. So, to begin and set the stage, I always like to acknowledge how the tobacco industry has modified the cigarette to make it more addicting. This is a diagram I discovered in an article that identified the areas of research that was being conducted. These are folks with deep pockets. It's helpful to acknowledge that tobacco mix that's used to make cigarettes has been repeatedly reformulated over the years to enhance its addicting properties. Here's a quote from Philip Morris scientists where they're talking about changes to smoke inhalation, nicotine retention, again, how influence the dopamine reinforcement. The cigarette of today has evolved into a highly sophisticated drug delivery device engineered to hijack the brain into addiction. Now, when we have a vulnerability due to substance use disorder or co-occurring disorder, that has a significant impact. If we look at the prevalence rates, for example, we'll find that it's much higher in the population that we treat in our programs. Right now in the United States, the adult smoking rate is somewhere around 19%. It's a bit higher for men than for women. I understand in New York State we're about 16% right now. But if you look at, for example, in substance abuse treatment, addiction treatment, there seems to be a correlation between the level of care and tobacco prevalence. Those with a more severe substance use disorder, we'd find like in an inpatient or a residential program, actually will have a higher rate and severity of tobacco addiction. Those with less severe substance use disorder tend to be in outpatient settings will have less. So I used to monitor this. I really haven't in a couple of years now, but typically at an outpatient site, probably 60-65% of the folks that are walking in the door have tobacco dependence. And again, if you go into inpatient or residential settings, you'll see that it is higher than that, closer to 80 or 90%. In mental health services, the rate of tobacco seems to be associated to a psychiatric diagnosis. So individuals with schizophrenia, for example, tend to have the highest incidence of tobacco. This is where you'll find that 90% range or so. Anxiety disorder is closer to 30 or 60%. Major depression is a little bit higher than that, towards the 80% range. So there's been numerous studies that show a wide range of data. Nonetheless, the overall prevalence is much greater than what we find in the general population. Nearly half of all the cigarettes in the United States, thereby, are consumed by individuals with an addiction or mental illness. The reasons for this, again, speak to a number of things, including, again, just a biological predisposition. There's behavioral factors in terms of how folks are self-medicating with tobacco use, their symptoms, as well as social factors. Cup of coffee, cigarette, daily meeting was the model for drug recovery for many years. And so that traditional thinking still plays a role in many, in the minds of many. Tobacco use is the primary cause of death among individuals with substance use disorder. Again, we know it's a major cause of death in alcoholics. More people die from tobacco use that are opiate dependent than from drug overdose, which is rather shocking. We have a pretty significant heroin and opiate problem in this state right now, and it's something that we're all talking about, but actually tobacco will cause more death than the use of their drug of choice, if you will. This is a comparison study, which I think many of us have seen, to show the various causes of death in the United States, and we can see tobacco dwarfs all of that. So if we look more closely now at the biopsychosocial definition of this, this is an interesting slide where when we start smoking cigarettes, we're doing it as a means of pleasure. It does enhance mood. It may pep you up in the morning, calm you down in the evening, give you a reason to have a little mini vacation during the day to take a break. We establish a tolerance and physical dependence on it, though, rather quickly. As we know, the half-life is around 2 hours. And after a while, the motivation for continued tobacco use is the withdrawal effect that kicks in. So you're not smoking necessarily anymore as a means of pleasure. We're doing it to get rid of the discomfort of the craving or the feelings of the withdrawal, and then that becomes the vicious cycle. Now, again, as we continue with this talk, I'm going to acknowledge how when we're pairing this up with other substances, there's a synergistic effect of how the use of the other substance will play a role in how the withdrawal effect from the nicotine triggers desire to smoke more. So we can see that there's a series of neurotransmitter systems that are impacted. It peps us up, calms us down. There's the reward reinforcement, as well as some pain reduction from the continuation of smoking cigarettes as we use that self-medicating effect. This is a slide that Dr. George, Tony George from the University of Toronto, showed me. And I love this slide because it speaks to, again, the primary and secondary factors here. The blue circles here is basically craving withdrawal syndrome. But if you look at the light green ones, these are, again, the influencing factors for continued use or relapse. And I find this interesting because it correlates the other drugs of addiction that we find common. The stress factors there in the neurotransmitter systems are common. What we find in alcohol dependence, cognitive enhancements, similar to other stimulants such as cocaine or, you know, the opiate use, we'll find. So there's an interesting recognition here of how there's shared pathways of how the neurochemistry is influenced when we're using tobacco to these other substances as well. So nicotine affects the same neural pathway as other substances. Tobacco use reinforces the effects of alcohol and cocaine. It's the pilot light to the furnace of the addiction, if you will. Years ago when I was at the John Norris Addiction Treatment Center and we were talking about this, one of the patients in the program made that statement where, you know, if every single time that I'm getting high on cocaine, he said, I'm chain-smoking cigarettes, the addiction is not to cocaine. The addiction is to the combination of how the cocaine and the nicotine influence my brain. And if I'm keeping the continuation of the tobacco use going after I stop my cocaine use, that's the pilot light to the furnace of my addiction. It's still lit. It's not total abstinence, which is where he was going with that. Tobacco use has a modulating effect on reducing cocaine-induced paranoia. We will find again that often cigarette smoking, chain smoking is common. Tobacco use in a population with substance use disorder thereby maintains rituals and social norms that serve to reinforce substance abuse coping beliefs. You got to have something. Don't take this away from me, too. So there's a continuation of active addict thinking, feeling, and behavior surrounding the tobacco use, which is sustaining some of the things that we address in drug rehab. How do we modify the behavioral patterns? How do we challenge the beliefs? How do we learn healthy coping skills? Drug dealing behavior and lifestyle. I learned this in a project I was working on looking at residential care, where I identified that in every single group home or community residence, there's at least one, usually more, but there's the tobacco man. And this is the guy who was a drug dealer out in the street before he wound up in treatment, probably at a very young age. His sense of self-worth is tied into his skill sets of dealing drugs. He's good at it. He has street credibility because of it. This is what he's known for. So this man now all of a sudden, or woman, is in a treatment program and is not dealing drugs. They're going to continue with those skill sets to sneak the cigarettes into the facility. And they get a lot of perks for manipulating the system and hooking people up, if you will. And so there's a whole dynamics that plays out, which is very counterindicated to the spirit of recovery. And so this is something, again, we were addressing head-on in that particular project. But that's a significant piece. I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. And then a drug acquisition activity and manipulative behavior. There is criminal activity. I have for years, I've been working in addiction services for over 20 years now, and I've always facilitated what I call tobacco awareness. Tobacco awareness is taking a neutral position on the topic. I'm not saying it's good or bad or healthy or unhealthy. It is what it is. How does tobacco impact your life? And open up the door with some just open-ended questions and reflections and hearing what people have to say about this. And when you do that over and over again, you're going to hear amazing stories of how the behaviors that are associated to getting your next cigarette are associated to the same lengths that people go through to seek out other drugs. There's definite parallels there to those types of behaviors. So as we walk through the drug recovery process, the cigarette is often this last thread, if you will, of a tangible link to the old identity, that person who is still active in addiction, while that person is becoming this person in recovery. The continuation of the tobacco use may provide a sense of familiar comfort. It's familiar, yet it inhibits some key factors in terms of changing the thinking or some of the behavior, some of the lifestyle changes that embrace recovery. Now, to demonstrate this or talk about it a little bit more, I want to share an experience I had at Odyssey House. This is a therapeutic community in Harlem. And I was invited to a community meeting there. There were approximately 50, this is all-male facility, there were approximately 50 residents at the meeting, and they invited me to talk about tobacco. So this is what we did. I went in there and we shared some information, again, looking at the basis of this from through the lens, if you will, of other drugs of addiction. So if you're drinking alcohol as a cigarette part of that ritual for you, if the answer is yes, is it sometimes there or always there? What happens if you have alcohol but you don't have a cigarette? How does that make you feel? So we're looking at this, and we would explore various substances, and people would share their experiences in terms of how they related to the topic. There was a gentleman that was sitting in the room, who really wasn't contributing verbally much, but by the end of the session, he raised his hand and he said, okay, now there's something that I need to say. And I'm going to paraphrase some of his comments, but basically this is what he communicated to us. He said, let me tell you why I need to stop my tobacco use. When I'm done with dinner here, do you know where I go? He said, I go to cop. I'm not going to cop any dope. I'm going to cop a cigarette. But he says, as I'm walking out the front door, I'm experiencing all the feelings I feel before I get high. He said, my mouth is, you know, I'm salivating. My heart is racing. I'm totally preoccupied with the thought of how wonderful it's going to feel to draw that smoke into my body and feel that little buzz, that little head rush that I get from it. This, of course, is a tobacco-free facility, so he's breaking the rules by leaving the facility and going to get that cigarette. Now, he took it a little further, though. He said, I'm putting myself into a high-risk situation. He's going into a particular area of the neighborhood where there's a lot of heroin dealing going on, so people, places, and things. He's putting himself in a high-risk environment. He said, and this again was his words, challenging his own thinking and behavior, which is what we do in drug treatment. He said, I'm justifying criminal activity. You can't buy a single untaxed cigarette from some dude on the street. That's not legal. So I'm justifying criminal activity. I buy that cigarette. I'm not casually smoking it. He said, I hit on it like it's a joint or a blunt because that's where I get my nice head rush, and I'm loving that buzz when it happens. And he said, then I come back to the facility. I keep it a secret because I can't tell anybody I did this. I'm breaking the rules. He said, now this is why I need to stop my tobacco use. Because of these cigarettes, I'm continuing this addict feeling, thinking, and acting out. I'm still manipulating the system. I'm still keeping secrets. I'm still getting high, if you will. I'm still in a position where he related this to what they call in 12-step teachings a half measure. He said, as long as I'm still acting out this behavior because of cigarettes, I'm not being honest in my recovery program. I'm taking a half measure in where that goes. This is an example of what I call tobacco recovery. Creating dialogue of this nature in a group setting in our treatment programs is very easy for therapists to do. We do this all the time with marijuana and, you know, other substances. To have the same kind of dialogue focusing on tobacco is a key aspect of how we can change the culture. We can, don't be silent, talk about this, and you'll hear amazing stories, and it can actually advance folks into different stages of motivation for within what I call tobacco recovery. So the two fundamental goals that we're looking at here at, for tobacco interventions within behavioral health services, engage in dialogue so that we can denormalize tobacco use within the treatment and recovery culture. Provide treatment then to assist our clients to establish and maintain tobacco integrated into their day-at-a-time recovery. This isn't an adjunct to your program. This is core to your recovery program. So this should be focused on in the same way that we talk about how to establish and maintain abstinence from other substances. So to expand upon that a little bit. The reason we have two levels of behavioral counseling is because of different stage readiness. So tobacco awareness should be something that is done for the entire patient population, and it's really engagement. Tobacco awareness is not health education. It's not talking about the health risks or the consequences of tobacco use. We have to take a neutral position on this. We don't want to be making a statement. So it's really all about, how does tobacco impact your life? Who would like to talk about that? And then, again, you can set the stage by, I usually explore drug use ritual. Because when you talk about the routines, the people, how people go through their various rituals while they're using their various substances, There tends to be patterns that we can sort of dissect and look at the pieces. And many times the cigarette is a major player to that, where, you know, I've had people tell me if I have a bag of dope and I don't have a cigarette, I don't even hit the dope until I hook up to that cigarette, where that's an opening for then further explanation. Well, it sounds like that's really important to you. Can you tell me why? You know, so you're tapping into that. Now, that's tobacco awareness in a group setting. But tobacco awareness can also be used in individual counseling. And this is, again, something unique to the area of healthcare that we work in, which I'm going to suggest we're not going to find in other disciplines. I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, Mary was her name. I met Mary in a continuing day treatment program, what we now call a PROS program. Mary had multiple dependencies on various substances, and she also had schizophrenia. Mary was a lady who was in her late 50s. She looked much older than her stated age. She had significant physical problems, most of which were tobacco-related. She was literally chain-smoking all day long. That was what Mary did. Now, Mary was in our system in this day program for many years. Everybody knew her and loved her. She was a very sweet lady. From time to time, when we would have new medical staff come on, you know, your heart goes out to her, and they would try to engage her in some type of tobacco quit program, and it really never took, and, you know, it never really amounted to any sustainability of her ability to stop her tobacco use. When I went to the program and met Mary for the first time, I was sitting next to her and I asked her if I could meet with her once a week to talk about her tobacco use. And the engagement was going to be more of a person-centered, I just wanted to form a therapeutic alliance with the woman. I mean, this is not a brief intervention. This was a let's get to know one another and talk about how tobacco impacts your life discussion. Now, it took 3 sessions. And after those 3 sessions, Mary shared with me something which was key to her barrier to stop her tobacco use. Now, this is speaking to her mental illness. What she shared was, I have snakes that live inside of me that bite me. They want to eat my intestines. And the only thing that quiets down those snakes is cigarette smoke. Now, she never shared this with anybody for years. But this was her reason for why she had to continue to put tobacco smoke in her body. Now, this, of course, was delusional thinking based upon her mental illness. But by hearing that, we now could work with that. So, Mary, would you like to learn how to quiet down those snakes? I worked with her psychiatrist. We used some NRT and combination medications. I taught her some mindfulness exercises and different behavioral interventions. And Mary was very successful in stopping her tobacco use. Now, if this was a very different intervention than Mary, you know, establish a quit date, this is how you use NRT, all of those brief interventions wasn't going to work for her. She needed something different. And the nature of the folks that work in behavioral health have an opportunity to the frequency and intensity of contact with the folks that we serve in our programs where we can generate this. That's tobacco awareness. Tobacco recovery is really just fundamental drug counseling skills. It's coping skills that we teach people in how to establish and then maintain the relapse prevention piece. And again, I will always suggest this is reflective of the best practices always with pharmacotherapy. So how this fits in the treatment stage-wise treatment. This is a SAMHSA description of it. We have client stages and processes that translate into engagement, persuasion, active, and relapse prevention phases of treatment. And you can see that there's various interventions there that are listed. A lot of folks are familiar with this model. A lot of our programs reflect it. I show here where tobacco awareness fits. Now, I call it engagement when I teach this with providers, but it really is motivation. It's all about persuasion. So the key, again, is how to facilitate that tobacco awareness within a routine type of process in as we practice. And then tobacco recovery, again, would be the active treatment phase or the relapse prevention. By the way, this is where Quitline can be very effective, where we can have people look at numerous ways of seeking supports and help and, you know, anywhere where they can find some guidance and direction is very helpful. Nicotine Anonymous online, there's a number of websites that we can look at as well with that type of support. But again, I think there's a very special nature of the therapeutic alliance that takes place with those in psychotherapy in our programs where we can't lose that opportunity in terms of reaching out to people. Okay, my PowerPoint is doing something weird. Here we go. Now, all of this needs to be framed in a recovery-oriented focus. Recovery is addition. It's not subtraction. We really don't quit things in life. We replace them. So, again, this is SAMHSA's working definition of recovery. There's different ways, I suppose, we could define recovery. But it's really looking at empowering one to improve upon their health and wellness in a self-directed way to achieve their full potential. So as we talk about this in tobacco awareness, it's not about, you know, the emphysema and the heart attacks and the deaths. It's all about instilling a sense of hope that change is possible and how this is going to enhance your mental health recovery or your drug recovery. Being alcohol and tobacco free is a very positive, proactive type of message. Now, the data shows that that is indeed the case. When alcoholics who are in treatment stop smoking concurrently, we see better treatment outcomes. We will find, again, numerous studies that have talked about this. The one that I quote the most is Judith Prochaska's work, where this was a meta-analysis, where she recognized the 25% increased likelihood of long-term abstinence from alcohol and other drugs when we concurrently address tobacco dependence. And again, that makes sense. If you think about what I shared so far, it's the correlation, the association of the patterns of how we use these other substances just continues with the cigarettes and the cigars and the like. Okay, now changing the culture, some of the social changes. I want to talk a bit about a project that I was involved in at the Charles K. Post Addiction Treatment Center. This is on Long Island in Suffolk County, and it's a fairly large inpatient facility. There's also a residential program attached to it. I spent a project there looking, it was actually a six-week project, and it was training for their staff on how to facilitate tobacco awareness. How do you create that dialogue in your program to start shifting beliefs of the overall population? Now, while we were doing this, I had a survey. I used to go to the facility every Monday morning and meet with the entire patient population where I would facilitate a discussion around tobacco awareness. All the staff then would observe, and this was part of their training. However, we also had a little brief survey that I would ask all the patients to fill out. It was five or six questions. And it was a scaling kind of thing from strongly agree to strongly disagree. This is some of the data that I wanted to share with you here. One of the questions was tobacco addiction should be treated in alcohol and drug programs. Now, this is just a four-week reinforcement of that. On November 17th, we had 64 patients in the room, and those who responded by saying, I strongly agree to this, was at 22%. By 4 weeks later, we were able to see a 46% response rate to that, suggesting, again, by talking about this, we're enhancing that awareness and changing some of the attitudes in the population. The awareness topics you'll see listed to the right of the slide, just so you know how I was facilitating that. On November 17th, the first session of this project, I spoke of tobacco use and other substances. On the second week, there was a group decisional balancing exercise. What are the costs and benefits of continuing tobacco use versus the cost and benefits of stopping tobacco use? And we, again, processed that as an entire group. Letting go of unhealthy relationships was the third part, where we identified how we fall in love with our substances because we view them as a means for emotional survival. So what's the grieving process? How do we develop the courage to say goodbye? And we looked at that with tobacco as well as with heroin and with alcohol and with marijuana. And so there was a whole approach of talking about that. By week four, there was a review and some discussion around behavioral defenses. And then by week five, I rotated back and started with that first session again. So it's important to know also that this clinic had open-ended groups. So you would have nearly 50% of the population would change every week, which was something we controlled for. But we wanted to see by just having a dialogue in the clinic and do it in some repeated fashion, how does it influence overall beliefs within that population. Another question was stopping tobacco at the same time as other substances is a good idea. Again, you can see here at the green line, only 16% strongly agreed to that statement day one of our intervention, and we were up to 38% after 4 weeks of talking about this. Nicotine replacement therapy is helpful. There's a lot of misinformation about NRT. So, again, there was a continuation, and their staff in the clinic certainly helped with this in a major way. But you can see day one, only 17% even thought it was worthwhile in terms of being strongly agreeing to that statement, where we were like a half, 49%, after providing that education within the context of these sessions. So the emphasis, again, tobacco awareness is what changes the beliefs. It increases awareness. It changes the culture. It enhances the motivation in helping people to ask for help and seek out tobacco recovery. Change strategies. Anchor the rationale for addressing tobacco to the organization's mission. Develop an alcohol, tobacco, and other drug policy. Okay, this is an integrated approach. I don't have a sign in my front parking lot that says heroin-free. We're an alcohol, tobacco, and drug-free parking lot so that we can respect one another in recovery and support one another while you're in treatment. And so that's the integrated message. We don't want to separate any one substance from the other. It's just a recognition that we don't do, you know, there's no shooting up at the front door, no lighting up at the back door kind of a message. Highlight the topics as a recovery issue that's communicated through the treatment philosophy that you subscribe to, 12-step teachings, TC principles, the principles of right living. The discussions around tobacco awareness need to be discussed through the lens of that philosophy. All right, it's not fundamental to just health education or other means of, you know, bringing in the specialist. Talk about this in the same language, in the same way as we talk about other substances. Strategically address the resistance to change. We need to measure, identify and measure where the resistance is. That's important. Provide targeted staff training after completing a needs assessment. One of the things that I learned when we were doing all the statewide trainings for the OASIS tobacco-free services regulation, many times I'd be in a room and I would realize that my audience was not ready to hear the message that was on the agenda for the day. And so organizations have stage readiness just as individuals do. You know, how well do we embrace this concept and, you know, kind of where do we go with that? So you need to tailor your training activity, your education, your awareness, you know, meet people where they're at, and you'll find the training will be more productive by doing that. we like to utilize the QI process in clinical supervision then to sustain the clinical interventions. This needs to be something that is monitored on a regular basis and brought back to clinical supervision so that folks are utilizing the protocols that we develop in our program. Use a language consistent with the treatment and recovery culture. I'm going to speak more to that in a minute. And then cultivate a consensus of all the stakeholders. We need to make sure everyone that's involved in that program has a say in what we're doing. This, when I provide technical assistance into programs, this is really the fundamental approach that we take. This is an example of components of care within addiction services. It may look different in different programs, but basically what drives behavior for those of us who work in our treatment programs is the required regulations and documentation that we need to do. So show me the documents that you use in your intake process or in your comprehensive evaluation. And are we then acknowledging or including tobacco within that particular information? When you're facilitating that evaluation, are you asking the same questions about tobacco as you would about alcohol or other substances? And if so, are we making a diagnosis? Is it reflected in Access 1? So you're looking at the paperwork that we're using that drives clinician behavior. In the orientation process, how are we talking about our alcohol, tobacco, and drug-free policy? In treatment planning, how is this shown in terms of your problem statements, your goals, your objectives, your methods? The program therapies, what do you do with it? You know, how does that tobacco recovery piece fit into the sessions that you're going to have, individual, group, some of the psychoeducation? All of the patient awareness and education that we do in drug treatment, and I will suggest a lot in living skills in psychiatric programming as well, could easily include talking about tobacco. You don't have to highlight it. You don't have to emphasize it. Just don't ignore it. So if we're talking about neurochemistry of the brain and how THC or heroin affects our brain, are we going to talk about how nicotine affects the brain? If you're talking about changing behavioral patterns to minimize triggers or cues for relapse and you're relating that to alcohol, you can talk about tobacco within that same dialogue. And so it's very easily integrated into the existing programming that we do. This is not extra work. It's just don't be silent. Include it in the process of what we are already doing in daily practice. Case review or, again, quality improvement. When we're reviewing cases, what stage of readiness is the patient in regarding their tobacco use? Are they in tobacco awareness? Are they in tobacco recovery? What's the treatment strategy that they're in? Upon discharge planning, do they have adequate access to nicotine replacement therapies? Or, you know, what is the plan for the person of how we're going to collaborate with other providers or provide some continuing care. So it's really looking at the system that exists, what is it that we may need to beef up or address, and then there's typically some related tasks where the training or the changing of some of the language and some of the policies and procedures would be helpful. Alcohol, tobacco, and drug-free policy, this is a sign that we actually used with the East House Corporation here in the Rochester. This was part of our Rochester Recovery Group Home project that I spoke of. And you can see this is not a sign that says don't smoke here or tobacco free or, you know, if you smoke, you're getting kicked out. This is a growth promoting, we need your help, pick up your mitt and join the ball game. You're part of this program. We support one another in recovery kind of a message. So we want to maintain a healthy environment. We're being informative by not using these substances. We support one another in what we're doing here. Thank you. All right. This is a sign just to translate into then what that more intense discussion in tobacco awareness sessions and tobacco recovery would play out. So those are the signs that we used for that particular project. reframing language. I'm looking at the clock, and I realize the time that we have left. Reframing language, if there's any one takeaway that I hope you would have from this talk, because I think this is so vital, is to think about the terminology that we use as we're talking about tobacco and addiction services. We want to make sure it's consistent to the language we use across the board. Now, for example, cessation is a term that I use when I talk to professionals, but I would never use it when I'm talking to my patients. We don't have heroin cessation programs in New York State. So if I'm talking about smoking cessation or tobacco, I'm already saying that tobacco is something different than everything else that we treat here. And again, I want an integrated message. So I'll talk about tobacco treatment, tobacco recovery, tobacco awareness. I use the same type of language that I would in referencing to our other programming. I don't like the term quit date. I prefer a recovery start date. Okay, recovery is what I'm working toward, not what I'm leaving behind. So this growth-promoting, learning type of process is what we want to encourage people to embrace. You enhance your quality of life by letting go of cigarettes. We're not quitting anything. We're adding something to our life. Smoking in itself has a lot of connotations to it. It's rebellious. It's sexy. It's, you know, all of those things where to just make a point, I'll emphasize, you know, hitting on your cigarette. You got your nicotine fix this morning when you woke up because you needed to feel normal. I'll say provocative things to generate a response where then we can create a dialogue. And again, you want to do that in a very respectful way, and you have to be mindful of stage readiness. I would never say something like that to someone in a pre-contemplative stage of change. But it's really using language that we can then push the envelope and create the dialogue and get people to speak to this topic in a way that they can be comfortable with. And a big one that I want to mention here is that it's not only the patients that we have to work with, but staff, the biggest barrier really to advancing tobacco programming in our service line is some of the staff that may still be tobacco dependent themselves. And we don't want to create a smoker versus non-smoker kind of setting. We need to let everyone know that they're a valuable and important part of the organization. So there is this parallel process where you have to have dialogues with the folks that work in these organizations, meet them where they are, and make sure that they realize that this is just improving the environment that we work into, and it's really all about patient care. We want to do the best possible job that we can for those that we serve in our programs. Folks will resonate to that. Oops. A couple of things I'd like to bring to your attention as far as some materials. There's free education and training videos on the OASIS website in their tobacco independence link. We actually developed a couple of videos through the professional development program at SUNY at Albany. And there's two videos. One is to show to counselors as staff training, and then there's one that could be used as patient education. That is free for download on the OASIS website. There's also other links on there in tobacco independence. Dr. Kipnis, the medical director at OASIS, has actually a lot of useful information on their website. TobaccoRecovery.org, this is the Tobacco Recovery Resource Exchange. Tons of stuff. This, again, is free training, where you'll see trainer manuals, participant manuals, various slides, all kinds of material that you can find for staff training, all free of charge. Of course, we all need to know about the clinical practice guideline. It was updated in 2002. That's our Bible for evidence-based approaches. But I also want to bring to your attention a manual that was developed by Dr. Sharp. Daryl Sharp at the University of Rochester had a program at Strong Ties where it was a nurse delivered tobacco intervention, and she manualized the project that they did there. I really like her her manual because it speaks to a lot about NRT dosing, how to assess for that. And so there's some good little workshops that Dr. Sharp developed. That, again, is downloadable free of charge at the Association of Psychiatric Nurses website. So the whole focus here today is I would encourage everyone to do what we can do to take a leadership role in addressing tobacco in our programs. The folks that we serve are most impacted by tobacco. As society as a whole is reducing their use of tobacco, there is this general subgroup that, as we saw, is not being impacted due to some comorbidity factors. I think that by talking about this, by creating dialogue, by instilling a sense of hope for behavioral change, by integrating this into our recovery message, I've seen this happen many times. It works. I mean, we can make a major difference in helping folks learn the coping skills that they need to establish and maintain tobacco abstinence. And by not talking about it, we're part of the problem. We're not really addressing it the way we should. We have the skill sets. I think, again, as if you compare this to other areas of healthcare, we have certain advantages by the nature of our programming and our frequency of contact with those that we provide treatment to. And I really think this should be something that we take advantage of. So I want to thank you for listening to what I have to say. I understand that I need to turn this over to Pat Bax. Pat, are you there?
Yes, Tony. Thank you. I'm the marketing coordinator for the New York State Smokers Quit Line. I want to thank you, Tony, for your excellent and very informative presentation. I also want to welcome our new and returning participants who are joining us for our call today. A gentle reminder that the New York State Smokers Quit Line is available statewide to assist you in helping your clients or your patients not only to become but to stay tobacco free. We provide free evidence-based cessation services and a variety of resources. Many of your patients or clients who are tobacco users may have selected quitting tobacco use for their New Year's resolution. And as those of us who do make resolutions know, it's oftentimes a struggle to keep them. So having that extra support can really be the catalyst to sustain change. So let us help you to be the cheerleaders for your patients and clients in becoming and staying tobacco-free. Tobacco users can call the Quit Line directly. They can register for nicotine patches online or be also referred through a provider referral. We offer free coaching, motivational coaching, a 2-week starter kit of patches, ongoing support, an array of resources, as you can see on our website, access to social media, messaging services, and online smoke-free community. Also, please watch for information that we are going to be posting on recognizing the 50th anniversary of the release of the first Surgeon General's Report on Smoking and Health with the release of the 32nd Surgeon General's Report on Smoking and Health, which is scheduled to be released on January 16th. I strongly encourage you to explore our website at nysmokefree.com for valuable, ready-to-use tools such as our referral program, downloadable materials like our chronic fact sheets on chronic diseases and our educational videos. If you are interested in learning more about how to refer your patients or your clients to us, including our policy-driven system-wide opt-to-quit program, you can call us directly at 1-866-697-8487. And in relation to today's call, I just want to mention that when our quit coaches do interview participants for nicotine replacement patches, they ask if their doctor ever told them if they had anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, alcohol abuse, drug abuse, or schizophrenia. And to put it in perspective, last year, 8.5% of those who interviewed did state that they had an alcohol or drug abuse diagnosis. So thank you for your role in 2013 to support your patients and your clients in their cessation efforts, including providing our resources to them and referring to the Quit Line. On behalf of the New York State Smokers Quit Line here at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in post-blizzard Buffalo, New York, we wish you and yours a healthy and prosperous 2014. And at this time, Wes, we will open it up for questions.
Certainly the floor is now open for your questions. If you have a question or comment, please press 7 or Q on your telephone keypad. The first question comes from Roberto Hoffman. Roberto, the floor is yours.
Hey, Tony. This is Robert and Terry from Tri-County Cessation Center.
And, hi.
How are you? Thanks for your call today. And I do have a question for you. As you know, we cessation centers are working strongly with community health centers and PRO sites. And at the same time, it seems these two demographics are meeting, you know, patient needs in slightly different contexts. And considering the similarity between how, you know, like mental health consumers and also a person without mental illness may relate to tobacco, I'm just curious that in these two different contexts, you know, in your experience, how do you relate to or how do you recommend that this language change be applied by practitioners, you know, this addiction recovery model, because these two demographics are, you know, really quite different but unified in their tobacco use?
Well, I think our state is going through a major change of integrating mental health and chemical dependency cultures, if you will, and, you know, that's going to take a while. You know, we spend a lot of time in the organization where I work having meetings talking about how to find more consistency and commonality in how we provide care in a more collaborative way. So I think there's some good opportunity here looking at the mental illness, looking at the substance use disorders, looking at physical health and well-being. This is where we're kind of going in as a state, I believe, with regard to advancing quality care in behavioral health services. I think there's a lot of opportunity now. I mean, we still have some bridges to cross and some further discussion to carry this forward. But to answer your question more directly, you make it consistent to your current treatment philosophy. And so whatever language you use within your programming in how you instill a sense of you know, meeting your treatment goals and objectives, just, all I'm saying is integrate the need to look at the tobacco use behavior in a similar way. And it's a very person-centered approach, which I find most mental health therapists that I work with are very receptive to. You know, we're really taking this very neutral position from the get-go is, can we talk about your tobacco use? You ask for permission, and then you explore with somebody, you know, kind of what, how does this affect your life? And you'll then hear the where that patient wants to go with it, and then you can offer, you know, to have some kind of a protocol in terms of addressing the tobacco. Keep it slow, you know, but keep it more intense. Dr. Novak, our colleague and friend from Strong Recovery here in Rochester, says the basic rule of thumb with this population is more is better. So more intense contact, more intense treatment and frequency and duration, higher dosing of nicotine replacement therapies, using them for a longer duration of time. It's how we can utilize our staff to help facilitate the dialogue, to start talking about this in a way that is positive and inspirational, and then having some type of services available to answer to those that say, yeah, I think you're right. I really want to do something about this. How do you write it into that treatment plan and then follow up with that? So it may look a bit different in different programs, you know, wherever we're situated, but I think that what we have in common is this sense of recovery is what we're finding now in our that we have in common that we can work with together. I hope that answers your question.
Great, thank you.
The next question comes from Diane Dunder. Diane, the floor is yours.
Yeah, I was curious to how you address e-cigarette use at your facilities or by your staff.
Well, I don't encourage e-cigarette use. I think the e-cigarette is just another drug delivery device, and I sort of address it in the same way as I would non-alcoholic beer or other means of using something. The behavior is still very much in place. I guess there's more current studies that are coming out now, one just within the last week or two, that suggested the there's nicotine and not many other toxins in the vapor from e-cigarettes. That wasn't really known up until more recently. Some of the researchers have discovered that. I just think, again, the to use it as a means for cessation hasn't been proven yet. There's a lot of anecdotal talk out there. The one study that I do know of that was cited by the FDA is that we really don't absorb the therapeutic level of nicotine to have it act as a nicotine replacement. So I question that right now. The jury is sort of out, but I really don't I'm not a big fan of e-cigarettes. I think that the e-cigarette is, you know, if I can see that it actually is like a harm reduction approach or it can help someone modify their behavioral pattern and actually then work towards establishing abstinence, that would be a good thing. I'm not sure that that is what is happening right now. I've been working in tobacco control for so long where I'm fairly skeptical about anything that comes out. And with regard to tobacco products, I'm concerned that the e-cigarette is more of just another drug delivery device. I know I've worked in the school districts in our region of the state here where e-cigarettes are used to vape a lot of other substances, synthetic marijuana, and, you know, it's a form of using for other purposes. So until we're more clear on all of that, can it be an aid? I don't encourage it at this point, and we don't recommend it here.
So is it restricted its use in the facilities then?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. We don't allow it.
Great. All right. Thank you.
Thank you again for a question or comment. Please press 7 or Q on your telephone keypad. At this time, there are no further questions.
Thank you, Wes. And thank you, Tony. It was a great presentation.
Thank
In
you.
Closing, I want to tell you that our next webinar will be on Wednesday, March 5th at 12 p.m. And on behalf of the New York State Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control, Tobacco Cessation Centers, and the New York State Smokers Quit Line, I want to express our appreciation for the excellent presentation today and thank you all who participated in today's call. This will bring us to an end. Have a great rest of your day. Thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's teleconference. We appreciate your participation. You may now disconnect your line at this time.